This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation talks about the Supreme Court's recent decision involving freedom of religion.
Unless you separate church and state, you're going to get what Jefferson called torrents of blood. The wall between church and state has been torn down by these reactionary judges on the Supreme Court.
As social justice activists deal with the aftermath of the Trump administration, Matt Meyer offers us six ways to stay focused on movement building amid what he calls post-election chaos.
This transition period is a dangerous one, and it's not going to get any better. Matt has some ideas on what we can do about it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
2 weeks ago, the United States Supreme Court made a 5-4 decision in the case of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn and Agudath Israel of America versus Governor Mario Cuomo, which reversed a precedent and crashed through the wall separating church and state. The men who wrote the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which separated church and state, were mostly not Christians. America was not created as a Christian country. This is a myth. Nor was it founded on Judeo-Christian principles. This is another myth. The founding fathers were deists. They were products of the Enlightenment. They did not believe in a God that played any role in human affairs. They understood from European history the terrible consequences of not separating church and state. Today's Christian nationalists and evangelicals, mostly Trump supporters, are relentless in their attempts to tear down the wall of separation. These people have substantial political power. They are much of Trump's base. They succeeded in getting Amy Comey Barrett appointed to the Supreme Court. 2 weeks ago, she, along with four reactionary Catholic judges, Alito, Kavanaugh, Thomas, and Gorsuch, prevented Governor Cuomo and his scientific advisors from limiting the number of people who attend Roman Catholic and ultra-Orthodox Jewish services in Brooklyn. This decision will cost lives in New York and nationally as it ties the hands of governments trying to limit the human toll of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today we speak with attorney Andrew Seidel, a constitutional litigator with the Freedom From Religion Foundation and the author of The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. Andrew Seidel, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Andrew, let's talk about the recent case called the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Brooklyn and Agudath Israel of America against Governor Andrew Cuomo. What are the salient facts in that?
Essentially, this is a challenge against Governor Cuomo's public health orders, trying to stop the spread of a lethal virus that has killed more than 250,000 Americans. The goal is obviously to stop the spread, protect public health, protect people, while giving them as much freedom as possible to continue to live their lives. And the Catholic Diocese, and then this Orthodox Jewish group challenged the order, claiming that it was religious discrimination, and it absolutely was not.
What are the relevant issues that this case raised in the Supreme Court?
Well, one thing that I think everybody needs to understand is, first, the case never should have been decided. The public health orders that the court blocked didn't even apply to the Catholic and Orthodox Jewish groups that were bringing the case. The orders had been changed by the time they got to the court. So, put another way, the case was moot or they had no standing to litigate it. Chief Justice Roberts said that it makes no sense for the court to order the governor not to do what he's not doing. Now, if you listen to conservative media or some of the conservative justices, right, they treated this as like a conspiracy theory to prevent the court from deciding the case, but it wasn't. These orders were meant to be responsive, to be nimble, to constantly be updated with the latest data on the spread of the disease. And again, the goal is to keep people safe while giving them and businesses and the community as much normalcy as possible. And so the case never should have been decided. It's kind of one of the big things that I think most people don't realize, and is, as a lawyer doing this kind of work, is really mind-blowing to see the court go out of its way to then decide this on an emergency basis, especially.
So how did the various justices come out in this case?
Good, great question. The order was unsigned. It's a per curiam opinion, which means we don't know who wrote it. Normally, justices sign their names. We do know that the five ultra-conservative justices, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, those last three all being Trump appointees, decided in favor of the churches. Justice Roberts, along with the three liberals, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, would have not decided the case or decided against the churches. There are a few different opinions that were signed. So Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurrence that was signed. So did Justice Kavanaugh. And the conventional wisdom at the moment seems to be that Amy Coney Barrett probably is the one who wrote this opinion. And it really is important to know that without Barrett, this case would have gone the other way, for sure. Roberts would likely not have weighed in on the merits of the order. So it would have stood either as a 5-4 the other way, possibly a 4-4-1. So Barrett is not only the reason that the case swung this way, but she's also the person who most people think wrote the opinion, in part because of how poorly it's written and the inexperience that it seems to show.
What was the reasoning that Barrett or whoever wrote it, how can they possibly rationally come to the conclusion that they came to?
Well, this is going to take a little while to explain because it doesn't make sense. I think you're having a hard time understanding it because it really doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. What the court did was weaponize religious freedom. So religious freedom has always been this personal protection that allows believers to believe whatever they want and act on that belief, to worship as they want, so long as they don't harm or injure others or violate somebody else's rights. And that's what this ultra-conservative Christian nationalist bloc on the court is changing. So that short unsigned opinion essentially stated that church's right to religious freedom includes the right to risk the health, safety, and lives of everyone else in the community. So the justices took this hallowed constitutional protection and made it into a tool to afflict and wound. They basically took a plowshare and beat it into a sword. And the way they did that was by crying religious discrimination. And that was essentially the hook that they hung the hat of their opinion on, right? Religious discrimination. That is what it boiled down to. The problem with that is that there was no discrimination. The churches were actually treated more favorably under these orders than other organizations and entities that they were nearly identical to.
Andrew, we've got to ask, what did you think when Justice Gorsuch wrote that it wasn't fair to limit visitors to the Catholic Church or Orthodox synagogues in as much as they weren't limiting visitors to liquor stores?
Yeah, I thought this was just such bad reasoning and so recklessly and deliberately blind. The five that signed on to the majority with Gorsuch, that, you know, they complained variously about hardware stores and acupuncturists, I guess is what you would call them, liquor stores, bike repair shops, accountants, lawyers, insurance agents, right? All of those were open with fewer capacity restrictions than churches. But again, religious worship is different than those one-on-one businesses or stores, right? People gather in large numbers, indoors, close together. They file in and out at the same time in big crowds. They sing, they pray, they chant when they go to church. And all of that helps spread the virus. We know that churches help spread the virus. There's a case study out of Ohio where one worshiper infected nearly 100 other people, half of whom never even stepped foot into the church. Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio said that it spread like wildfire. And this was before, this was in August, before things got really bad. So churches are different than liquor stores or bike repair shops or even that one-on-one acupuncture appointment. They are much more like going to a movie or taking in a play or listening to a lecture or watching an indoor sporting event. And this is the key point. All of those were banned under the New York orders that the churches were complaining about. Churches, however, were still allowed to meet, either 10 or less or 25 or less, depending on which zone they were in at the time. So when you compare apples to apples, churches were actually favored under the stay-at-home orders. They were given special privileges, but that wasn't enough. So they, instead, they cried discrimination because they weren't given the most favorable treatment out there. And again, that decision was made to protect public health, to save lives, and not on the basis of religion. It was on the basis of characteristics that relate to the spread of a lethal virus. But you still had five of the six members on the court's conservative bloc agree that this was discrimination, which is really just mind-blowing and a deeply alarming signal for what is to come.
Yeah, I'll say. Amy Comey Barrett is a member of an evangelical Christian sect that supports Trump. He obliged them and picked her in an attempt to stabilize his eroding support among white evangelicals. He handed over the selection of the nominee to the court to a small group of evangelical leaders. My question, Andrew, is it unconstitutional to pick someone for public office because of their religion?
That's a really good question, and it's something that we've seen come up quite a bit in the wake of the Barrett nomination. So the relevant clause of the Constitution is Article 6, Clause 3, which bans religious tests for public office. And that is a very, it's a very strong provision of the U.S. Constitution, very concrete. No religious test shall ever be required of any public office or trust under the United States. No shall ever any. These are strong, clear mandate. In a document that's full of a lot of waffling, deliberately sort of nebulous language, you had this one clear statement. And one of the reasons I love it is that this is something that was truly original and unique about the U.S. Constitution. We were the first country to ban religious tests for public office and first written constitution to do that, something that we ought to be very, very proud of, in my opinion. But there's a debate going on about whether or not the language prohibits a president or another elected official from choosing people based on their religion as a sort of characteristic that would allow them to do their job well. And this goes to a big problem that we saw during Amy Coney Barrett's nomination. When she was nominated for the Seventh Circuit, Dianne Feinstein famously said that the dogma lives loudly within her, and that comment blew up in the media, and people said that that was a religious test for public office. So a lot of people who say that it was a violation of Amy Coney Barrett's freedom to ask her about her religion then turn around and say her religion is the reason that we need to put her in office in the first place. So there's a lot of bad conversation going around this. And I've written a number of pieces for Religion Dispatches and Rewire News Service elsewhere talking about why, what the religious test means and why it's important and okay, for instance, for senators to question judicial candidates about whether or not they will honor the oath of office that they have to take, which is also in Article 6, or whether they're going to hold the Bible or their holy book above that oath of office. And it's deeply problematic. But to answer your question more directly, it's unclear. There's no law directly on point.
Andrew, please talk about any recent important church-state separation cases.
And this is a huge one. This really is a big one, even though it was a emergency case. I mean, what the court said was, if you don't give churches the most favorable treatment possible under the law, we're going to block whatever you're trying to do. Anything less is unconstitutional. In other words, the right to religious freedom is now tops in this brand new hierarchy of rights. And I think we're going to see some other rights tossed in there by this conservative bloc. The Second Amendment rights will probably get elevated in the hierarchy. Well, reproductive rights, including possibly the right to contraception, will be downgraded, along with another haunting possibility, equal marriage. Again, all this goes back to Amy Coney Barrett. There has been an attempt over the last really 5 years, but you can trace it back even farther, again, to weaponize religious freedom. And that is really what they are doing in this case, to turn that hallowed protection into a tool, a weapon to impose that religion on others. And we are seeing it more and more in the cases. There was an Espinoza versus Montana case that came out of Montana that the Supreme Court decided last term, which essentially said that Christian parents that want to send their kids to private religious school have a right to access taxpayer funds to pay for that religious schooling. That has always been held to be a violation of religious freedom, and that was flipped on its head. The court upheld a 40-foot-tall Christian cross on government property that was, you know, we're paying $200,000 to maintain. They said that that was perfectly fine. It would have been a violation of religious freedom to take it down, even though the Constitution demands it. And there's a very scary case out of Philadelphia this term that the court is going to hear argument on called Fulton versus Philadelphia. And we're expecting a decision probably in the spring, possibly early summer. And that could say that your religion is a right to discriminate against LGBTQ people. And the problem with that is that once you grant a license to discriminate in the name of God, there's no place to draw that line. If you can discriminate, you can discriminate against anybody for any reason, on the basis of race or on the basis of sex. So I'm deeply worried about where this court is going. This is a decision is a very, very bad omen.
Yeah, well, the Hobby Lobby case before Amy Coney Barrett came on the course scared us all because it gave a religious cover for people who wanted to deny birth control to their employees. But Andrew Seidel, I wanted to ask you if you could do this in a nutshell, which is a tall order, but in a nutshell, what's the history that disposed the founding fathers to make a separation between church and state? It came out of European history, principally in England. In a nutshell, can you tell us what was going on there and why they thought they had to put that provision into the First Amendment?
Torrents of blood. That's what James Madison said. And I write about this a lot in The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. The founders surveyed the history of religion and government, actually both in the Old World and incidentally in the New, especially looking at the Puritans and Pilgrims in Massachusetts. And they decided to eschew and reject theocracy and intolerance and condemn those torrents of blood spilled in the name of religion. You know, Jefferson looked back at the millions of innocent men, women, and children who had been burnt, tortured, fined, imprisoned, and yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity in Christianity. So the founders really rejected unifying state and church and mandated that separation because of the torrents of blood that had been spilled throughout history. And we are now victims of our own success. You know, state-church separation has been so successful in this country that we are now seeing the Supreme Court of the United States rejecting it as a principle because they don't grasp how dangerous it is to let them be unified.
Andrew, Michael and I were surprised to learn that religious organizations received up to $10 billion in the first round of COVID-19 aid. And that includes the U.S. Catholic Church getting $1.4 billion and possibly up to $3.5 billion. What do you make of this?
And this was something that the Freedom From Religion Foundation was yelling about. You know, we were the voice in the wilderness yelling about how big a problem this was. We actually published some secretive White House calls that showed that the Trump administration and White House was funneling money to Trump's closest supporters, preachers. We were deeply, deeply concerned about this from the beginning. It is absolutely a violation of every American's religious freedom for the government to tax citizens, use that coercive taxing power, take money out of your pocket, and then turn around and give it to a church that you do not belong to, a church that condemns you to hell if you don't believe in their particular God. This is why that Montana decision that I mentioned the Supreme Court got wrong earlier, why they got it wrong. So this is a deeply, deeply alarming decision. And there was no appetite in Congress to challenge it in any way. There was no good vehicle to challenge it in court in any way. And then the court decided that Montana case and essentially waived off any possible challenge. We are still at the Freedom From Religion Foundation digging into all of the different violations that arose out of this PPP program. Because it's not just the giving money directly to churches. Some of those churches were able to double and triple dip, right? So the Catholic Church that you mentioned, the Catholic Church at the local level might have gotten a PPP fund. Then the diocese might have gotten it. Then the archdiocese might have gotten it. And that's because the Small Business Administration suspended the rules that would normally prevent that from happening as it applied to churches. Just one of the many instances of favoritism that we saw towards religion in the program when religion should have been excluded altogether because of the Constitution, because of the separation of state and church. So this is deeply, deeply worrisome and something we're going to be picking apart, I think, for years to come.
We've been speaking with Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a terrific organization. Andrew, can you tell us in a nutshell what you're working on now and how people can follow your work and the work of the Freedom From Religion Foundation?
I hope everybody goes and joins FFRF. We are at FFRF.org. I am on all the social media places, Andrew L. Seidel, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and I've got my book, The Founding Myth, out, and I'm just starting to write my second book, which is titled Weaponizing Religious Freedom, so keep an eye out for that.
Heidi and I are grateful for your good work, Andrew, and we'll have you back on when the second book comes out, or maybe even before, and maybe even hopefully to talk about a victory.
I would absolutely love that on all fronts.
Andrew, thank you so much, and really great respect for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Heidi. It's always a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In a 2018 Gallup poll, half of Americans called the state of moral values in the United States poor. 37% say moral values are only fair. Over the past 4 years, a perfect storm of incompetence, misinformation, and reckless decisions by Donald Trump have left a stain not just on moral values, but also on democratic institutions and the rule of law. In a chillingly politicized decision, for example, the new overtly right-wing Supreme Court has signaled its preference for religion over public health in its first opinion, limiting states' rights to protect residents from the COVID-19 virus. As we transition from what no doubt will go down in history as the worst presidential administration in U.S. history, much of the nation is plagued by widespread depression and hopelessness. But bad times for the country also provide new opportunities for social justice organizing. Longtime activist and writer Matt Myers' recent blog for Waging Nonviolence is called Six Ways to Stay Focused on Movement Building Amid the Post-Election Chaos. Matt offers concrete suggestions, in effect a moral assignment for the masses, for surviving and acting in the wake of 4 exhausting years under a divisive narcissist. Matt Meyer is author of several books on resistance and social change, published chiefly by PM Press and Africa World Press. He's the Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association, a longtime leader of both the War Resisters League and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the senior research scholar of the Resistance Studies Initiative, and an advisory board member of Waging Nonviolence. Matt is also on the board of the New York-based A.J. Musty Institute that funds grassroots activist initiatives for half a century. Matt Meyer, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about Waging Nonviolence, where you're a blogger, and its relevance in the current period.
Well, Waging Nonviolence was started several years ago as a key source of peace and justice news. They're really committed to journalism, not just to posting about people's ideas and thoughts. So that's important. They want as much as possible hard journalism about peace and justice actions around the world. But I think the key thing about this current period is that about a year and a half, 2 years ago, Waging Nonviolence moved a step beyond just journalism and online reporting and blogging to create a community of groups that utilize the site as sort of their own, not exactly homepage, they don't substitute for their own websites, but as a community space to have conversations cross-organizationally and for explicit movement building. So groups like War Resisters League and War Resisters International, Fellowship of Reconciliation and the International, FOR, a variety of different academic groups, Pache Ibene, and interfaith groups, they're all utilizing Waging Nonviolence as a special community space. And I think it's that kind of online, web-based, virtual movement building that we're going to see more of and we need to see more of in the coming period.
Matt Meyer, let's talk about the challenges we face. Do you think that activists at this point in history have greater challenge than in prior times? And if so, how and why?
Well, you know, speaking as an historian, you know, donning that part of my life in my hat, it's always trickier to say greater than or worse than. Obviously, this has been a significant historic year, and we have challenges in the year to come that are as great as many that have been faced in our lifetimes. But I'm also cautious because I remember just a few years back, most of us saying about a certain former president who had a middle initial of W, oh my God, this is the worst possible president we could ever imagine having. Well, it turns out our imaginations weren't that good because just a few years later, so I think the stuff like words like greater than concern me, but clearly we are in a major challenge because in any case, whoever would have won, whatever would have happened in November, the right wing is growing. It is consolidating. It is increasing their arms. And so those of us who are interested in something called law and justice, who are concerned about the increasing disorder, have our work cut out for us in the year to come.
Matt, you're in the leadership of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Can you tell listeners what that is, and also what role do faith-based communities play in fighting for social justice change?
Yeah, thank you, Heidi. I'm really now active in the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, though was recently the national co-chair of the U.S. FOR. FOR is essentially the oldest peace group in the U.S. To bring together peoples of various faiths. It's close to 100 years old, and I think has a special responsibility at this moment to talk about unity beyond simple acts of reconciliation towards things like reparations, towards things like understanding that truth and justice has to in some ways precede or at least go hand-in-hand with the question of reconciliation, because reconciliation without resistance cannot bear much fruit. However, I do think there's amazing roles that can be played, and I want to point to one of them right now that's, I think, close to the hearts of many Law and Disorder listeners. Just a couple of weeks ago, FRUSA broke a story about a project that I've been deeply involved with the headline, Tutu, Gandhi, and King Descendants, call for clemency for New York State imprisoned elder activists. And this is basically an extraordinary campaign where Dr. King's daughter, Mohandas Gandhi's granddaughter, Archbishop Tutu, and other Nobel laureates all joined together in an open letter to New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo calling for the release of David Gilbert. And David Gilbert, for any of those who do not know, is a 76-year-old political prisoner, an activist who throughout the 60s and 70s did some extraordinary work and is beloved by many, many, and has been in prison for decades and decades now. And if not for the fact, even if it weren't for the fact that he's done his time, that he's shown remorse, and that he is really someone who not only does not pose any danger to the community, but would clearly be an asset to any communities that he would join, it is on purely humanitarian basis an obvious, should be easy ask that David be released, given COVID-19 racing through and raging through New York State and prisons throughout the U.S. And at 76, David is highly susceptible to the worst effects of COVID. So to have an incredible interfaith group, you know, we looked at the papal encyclical, the Pope's commentary of October, which talked about questions of reconciliation, questions of the death penalty and justice in terms of incarceration, and specifically cited Gandhi, King, and Tutu as three of the leading figures that were not Catholic that inspired him as the Pope. And to have those three figures or their descendants join together now to call for the release of David Gilbert and the release of all elders in prison who are or should be eligible, that was a major important act, and FRUSA was, I think, proud to help coordinate that.
Yeah, thank you for working on that, Matt. You know, I'm a friend of David Gilbert's. I visit him regularly until the plague set in. I got that email that you sent out, and I sent a letter to Governor Cuomo. We'll post on our Law and Disorder website the connection, so if listeners want to send a letter, they can. But I wanted to ask you about your blog post on movement building. We're in this dangerous situation, as you described, when the Biden administration is coming in and Trump is transitioning out. What prompted you to write this particular blog post?
Thank you. And Michael, I'll say your work to support David is so well known. And you know, in a different space, as someone who's been a leader in the peace and nonviolence movement for decades, I've also visited David since the mid to late 1980s. And in these deep conversations I've had with him over the decades, it's really clear to me that from a nonviolence perspective, from a peace perspective, from a justice perspective, from any perspective you might look at it, it is time for David to come home. But in terms of the blog post and my recent article, I guess the main motivation was the worry that there was a little bit too much joy when, you know, it was clear that Biden had won. Because though the 79 million people that came out and voted for Biden is an amazing number and a number absolutely born of political organization, you don't get 79 people doing anything without organization of some type. It's also clear that the opposition got similarly high and extraordinary numbers. So we are in a period where I think 2020 was not the most important election of our lifetime. I think the coming two or three years, and especially 4 years from now, when it is very likely and possible that the right will become more consolidated, and that, in fact, a character, if not Trump himself running again, a character that is actually smarter, slicker, more charismatic, and less open to foibles and failures than Trump, might replace that man to a new, improved, better neo-Nazi. And that is a fear we have to struggle and build against whomever is in the White House and whatever whoever is in the State House, whatever is happening electorally. We have to build an anti-fascist movement with greater strength in the years to come.
Matt, that actually dovetails with our next question. The first of your six talking points involves the fact that Trump is not acting alone in what you say is, quote, altering reality based on his house of lies. What do you propose we do in this respect?
Well, I think we have to first know our enemy. It's interesting. I'll use this conversation to point to some of the linked or hyperlinked items in my article that may be more difficult to find. Because that first point really speaks to knowing our enemy. And I rely on a colleague, Matthew Lyons, and the website Three Way Fight to really take apart some of the facets and the schisms within the Republican Party, within the fascist, neo-fascist movements, within the right-wing populist movements in general. So it's noteworthy when Bill Barr does what he does. I just posted this morning this piece from Gabriel Sterling, a Republican official in Georgia, who had a passion plea yesterday to the president and to Republican Georgia-based lawmakers to stop the craziness. And so the splits, as well as the allegiances within the right wing, need to be understood by us. And that's the first of the talking points that I thought was key.
Your second point is consolidation into a full-fledged movement. That's been the challenge for the left historically, of course. How do we do this consolidation?
I think there are two things we have to note to sort of move beyond past errors and past history. One is that we're not going to have, we've never had a movement with teeth in this country that didn't acknowledge and understand some level of black and so-called people of color leadership. The huge anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia came on the heels of and was totally pushed by the black liberation and so-called civil rights movement of that same era. So I think we have to recognize black leadership. We have to recognize black women's leadership. We have to recognize the leadership of people of color. But the other piece I think that is significant is the idea of building coalitions and united fronts that are flexible enough to understand that no one tactic, not even a single strategy, and certainly not a single ideology, is going to bring us to where we need to go. We need to build cross-ideology. We need to accept people from different parts of the left, and we need to understand that more than one tactic at one moment will be employed and has always been employed in any major campaign and certainly anything worth calling itself as a full-fledged movement.
On the third talking point, you reference Trump's power in mobilizing a base that overtly embraces white supremacy, patriarchy, and militarism and nationalism. How do we counter this?
So, Heidi, I'm going to answer that quickly because I think it dovetails a lot of the previous two answers I gave. But essentially, the one-word answer is we counter this overtly. There's not one way to dismantle white supremacy, for example, or to try to take it apart. Although, again, here I'll cite our colleagues at the Syracuse Cultural Workers, the great calendar and poster makers, who just put out a poster on dismantling white supremacy. It's a poster, but if you look at it carefully, it reads more like a kind of medium-sized pamphlet because there's a lot of words in it, but it really sort of speaks to how grassroots activists can do that. But in terms of all that the right embraces, we have to deal with things overtly. We have to take them on directly. But we also have to understand that there's not one single way to fight against any of those evils and oppressions.
You called Joe Biden, and I thought this was really brilliant, a blue MAGA. And you assert that we need an explicitly revolutionary, nonviolent movement to defend all people's organizing. What would that look like?
So I'm so happy with this question, Michael, and it gives me a chance to write a little wrong. Waging Nonviolence did not want me to put in acknowledgments because it's not sort of the journalistic way. But Blue MAGA is completely a conception of my very brilliant 20-year-old son. So I have to credit Michael Meyerstar for that phrase here publicly on Law and Disorder. I asked him if I could use it, and he did give me permission. The fact is, for us, I think revolutionary nonviolence has to mean a movement that understands that mere reforms are not enough. They are important. They are significant. But we are building for something more than just a newly elected official, more than just a small change in a law that could be changed back again 2 or 3 or 5 or 15 or 20 years from now. We're looking to build a movement that is more radical than all that, that looks at the roots of injustice and oppression at all that. Oh my gosh, maybe even looks at capitalism and patriarchy and militarism. But I think also we have to understand that the power of nonviolence in some ways has not been fully utilized. Not the dogmatic nonviolence that tells people what they can and cannot do, but a nonviolence that involves creative, militant, massive, unarmed action. And what it looks like, and again, this has been talked about and continues to be talked about, you know, in this conversation and in every organization that we have, it's about organizing. It's about building organization. It's about, you know, that what Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael said were the three main things you had to do to make social change. Three main things. Organize, organize, organize.
I confess that number 5 in your talking points is my favorite. You say that we must be appealing, use positive messaging, build bright cultural icons, and tell the truth as we go well beyond preaching to the choir. Please discuss.
Well, I thought you were going to say, as you were starting out, that I said we had to have fun, which is a summary of all that you just listed. And yeah, I really think this is a long-haul struggle. There is no question in the many, many Zooms that I go through in the course of the day that people are exhausted by more than three things. You know, living safely in the pandemic has been exhausting in the U.S. especially, but around the world. Living in this election cycle, whatever one's tactical and strategic approach to the election, has been exhausting. And thinking about gearing up for more work ahead, as I'm suggesting we desperately need to do, is exhausting just to think about. So the only way through it is through also having some fun. I'm part of a group, this is a Movements of Movements group that has been doing some seminars and webinars this last period, that decided we were going to take off December. We decided, no, we can't even really put together a forum and webinar in January. We're just a little bit too exhausted. However, the idea of having the group of us that was part of the webinar series these last months have a little virtual cocktail party in December seemed eminently possible and also necessary. So yes, we have to treat ourselves in whatever ways seem fun and creative, just the way we have to be creative about the way we speak to the world and the way we organize and build politically. We have to have fun and be creative to one another and internally and within our own work. And so, yes, I listen to late-night comedians, and I read the poignant political section of The Onion magazine. It seems at times like irony was dead in this last period, as the most bizarre thing seemed to be real. And yet, I still get a chuckle when I read some of these satiric sites and listen to some of these comedians and think, yes, what Bertolt Brecht said was correct. In dark times, there will be singing. There'll be singing about the dark times.
You urge building for a people's strike, What do you mean by that? What does history teach us in this respect about a people's strike?
Well, first of all, people's strike means two things. First, it's an organization that just began to build in April of last year as the pandemic was beginning to spread intensively and also gearing up to May 1st. So People Strike is a coalition. One can look at the words peoplestrike.org and find the website. It was initiated by colleagues of ours in Jackson, Mississippi, the group Cooperation Jackson, which Kali Acuna and others have led in very inspiring ways. But it's also grown into something closer to a united front. It's not particularly huge, and it's not exactly ready to take over anything, but it involves key and core organizers from many of the cities, movements, uprisings that we've seen in these past months. So I have some hope, and my work in coalition goes back decades, and in some ways, though, I never met A.J. Mustey, whose name is associated with both Heidi and myself in terms of the Mustey Institute. Most of Mustey's younger lieutenants were people who trained me in coalition work in the early 1980s. And the fact is, I've never seen a coalition potential as positive as People Strike. However, beyond the organization and beyond getting involved in helping to build that effort, it's also true that when I talk about and when I think about militant tactics and we talk about intensified tactics, the idea of more generalized strikes has been almost crazy to talk about in the U.S. context over the last decades. But over the last months, there have been shifts. So, for example, as an educator and as a former full-time professor and before that high school teacher, I've been very impressed and affirmed with a major leader from Los Angeles, the president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, Cicely Meyer-Cruz, who's also been part of the People's Strike Movement, who has become a prominent national leader. She is the president, again, of the L.A. local of teachers' unions, who has been talking about the need for more militant, more intense actions. So we need to be uniting these voices within church, within labor, within all of the community-based movements, and we need to be looking at how we can collectively, nationally and internationally, build for something more creative but also militant in the coming year.
Matt, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Tell us how our listeners can follow your work and hopefully get involved.
Well, again, Heidi and Michael, thank you so much for having me back. We don't love the lack of law and the disorder in the society, but we love the radio show Law and Disorder, and it's always a pleasure for me to be on it. I guess the best ways to follow most of my work, in addition to Waging Nonviolence that carries a lot of my shorter articles, is to look for me in PM Press, which publishes most of my longer work, and in Africa World Press. As far as other activism, I think you've heard it. The main way to follow me is to follow the work and get involved to build the resistance, however is best in one's own community and local area, because it's through collective local action that we will make greater social change.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope to continue our conversation in the near future. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Matt. You take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye. Stay safe.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM Radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIFFM 104.7 FM Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
Well, you dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The I, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois,
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington, WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia, KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California, KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington, WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania,
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California, KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington, our streaming planet podcast, WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas, 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas, 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas, WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont, Black Sheep Radio,
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California, KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska, KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington, WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska,
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio, WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Workforce Rising Online, KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.